The information where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.
The Nature of Trust. Two articles from our winter 1999 edition, which are both about environmental issues, and I'll try and link them up more at the end. First, wildlife trust or untrusty. Worthy ends don't justify dubious means, so it was sad to see them shrouded in a bizarre display of audience manipulation. Where? Brighton Town Hall, May 21st, 1998. A talk by Ian Scott, director of the Wildlife for All Trust, entitled A Deeper Approach to Nature Conservation. The audience? An invited group of environmental campaigners. Scott first spoke about tiger conservation in India, criticising methods of population count used by the World Wildlife Fund. He panned similar NGOs, such as Greenpeace, over its Brent Spar campaign, saying how they used panic science to defeat Shell Oil. Ranging into charities generally, Scott said they were empire building on funds and paying huge salaries. Scott then turned on the public, saying it was me, 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 which threatened society. We are all equally selfish and responsible. Claiming the work of many psychologists, Scott said we were naturally prone to be selfish rather than self-preserving. He added overpopulation was a big cause, saying, I think flippantly, it would be better to put human populations in national parks and let nature evolve beyond. He had seen third world suffering at first hand, which simple provision of, for example, mineral salts would alleviate. Scott had held a dying 15-year-old girl in his arms, and it is hard to disagree with such passion. Provocative stuff, so why dubious means? In the front row were three children who Scott referred to, saying he had led a far less materialistic life at their age. They were sympathetic, yet Scott didn't refer to them once or twice, but continually throughout the meeting. This was particularly tasteless when it came to the population control aspect. Are you related? He asked, implying perhaps how the third should not be there. Yet a strange agenda emerged later, with Scott wanting to extend lifespans to 150 through medicine. No one would say no, he claimed to sceptical groans. Eugenics and the super race? Genetic manipulation is medicine. Scott also manipulated audience discussion. Obviously, the environmental groups tried to defend their salaries, which may be modest by big business standards, but riches to the third world. Again, a worthwhile debate. But a group of three continually interrupted valid counter-arguments, breaking the flow, while Scott talked down questioners. It was only a black-and-white argument, we are selfish or not. I suspected the three to be plants, and discovered they worked for Scott when I spoke to them afterwards. Good to liven it up a bit, said one. Hardly a fair debate. I told Scott personal attacks were pointless, since we all start somewhere. NGOs are tools in the box of change, if imperfect. But should he question some fundamentals more? Maybe Greenpeace had been wrong, but without fossil fuel culture, Brent Spar would never exist. Advertising brainwashes us into victims of a kind. Another person asked how could kids living on inner-city estates relate to Scott's lofty intellectual arguments. Scott has travelled the globe honing his theory, fare presumably paid by the same public he condemns, and now uses the confrontational tricks of the NGOs he so despises. Yet Scott restated his black-and-white theory, we're all good or wrong, regardless of circumstances. He quoted an Apollo astronaut's view from the moon, saying this showed how precious the Earth is. Well, I mentioned the moon hoax concept of fake Apollo landings, which left him rather speechless. More pragmatically, if the billions spent on Apollo had been spent on the Third World, would it be in such a dire state now? Scott styles himself as a visionary who believes he knows the whole truth, and his passion justifies dubious means. Yet he oversimplifies issues like any Save the World NGO, even on valid points. Scott also neglected politics or war, ultimately fields for a more honest debate. Offering no advice for practical action, condemning local activism as selfish, Scott left a bewildered and angry crowd. Scott has established the Wildlife for All Trust as a registered charity. For the prestige he criticises in others? Could his intention be to cause dissent, disrupting the Green Movement? Scott even said, "Question me, I may have agendas of my own." Honest irony, perhaps. Yet his dodgy tactics and audience plants cast him in a poor light. The information wrote to Mr. Scott to clarify these points, but received no reply. Moving on now to GMO or NWO. In information number one, we mentioned genetic engineering as a possible component of a global rule conspiracy. Could it be the single most frightening component of such a plan? The current NGO genetics campaigns have achieved considerable impact. Aimed at consumers, stickers indicate foods containing GMOs, genetically modified organisms, which have unknown effects on future health and biodiversity. But could the food aspect be part of a far more sinister agenda? Imagine you wish to promote the popular usage and safety of genetic engineering. Where better to do so than with foods? Why, if it's safe to eat, then it must be safe. What next? Asks the campaigner's cryptic logo, evoking TV's Mulder and Scully. But perhaps Greenpeace, Friends of the Earth and others have fallen on such a case. Conventional campaign groups often skirt amazingly near the territory claimed by conspiracy theorists, and it is often a mere difference of approach which masks common areas. Divide and rule. This supergenetics theory occurred to me like this. I woke early on June 2nd, 1998 and couldn't get back to sleep. Switching on the radio, I heard a piece on Farming Today before 6 a.m, which said Monsanto, the US agribusiness which creates the reviled GMO foods, is buying heavily into pharmaceuticals. The reasons given were the usual synergy, it's good for business, the consumer, etc. However, with the first patents now granted for human tissue, a link between genetics and medicine is clear. With blood and other products subject to patent, we can assume the patent owner has control over their use. But why should a company so successful perfecting GMOs bother with pharmaceuticals? The fact is, Monsanto's GMO soybean, itself the subject of much controversy, needs the company's own patent weed killer, Roundup Ready, to which it is immune. So imagine such a company tampering with human biology. Could it sell GMO cells, blood, etc., and also make them reliant on their own medical products? Forget Auntie Maggie's homemade remedy. Worse, if we frame such techniques within a future global rule scenario, this symbiotic GMO medical technology would allow selective population control through the use of eugenics and the controlled availability, or otherwise, of the vital patent medicines. No others would work. There is a scene in Jurassic Park where it is explained that if a dinosaur escapes, it will die quickly because its genes have been altered. Its food contains a chemical which it must eat every day or die. This would stop dinosaurs surviving long if they escaped and causing havoc. Given such close links between genetics and medicine, it could be possible to introduce a genetic factor into humans and thus blackmail them into compliance. How? Perhaps under the cover of some future mass health program, like a wonder treatment. For example, if young women were persuaded this could benefit future children, they might comply, only for the manufacturers to discover a drawback, a la thalidomide, offering a drug's solution. This would put a whole generation under its direct control and reliant for existence on its products. A possible example of disinformation occurred on August 10th, 1998, when it was announced on World in Action, the ITV programme, that GMO food could adversely affect the human immune system. On the 12th, the scientist responsible was sacked for mistaken research. Had he uncovered the truth, or was it a ploy to trivialise such findings as unreliable? The whole affair happened uncannily fast. Well, two pieces there. As I said, both really coming off the Green Movement, my involvement with the Green Movement. One, a practical example of attending a public meeting, which goes a little differently than you expect. And the other, more of a theoretical piece. I'll first say a little bit about the Wildlife Fraud Trust. I mean, they used to put posters around town on various shop fronts. Had some charity shops making money for their two wildlife reserves, one in Sussex and one in Africa, bizarrely, kind of strange global empire. I've got nothing against them. These are just my reactions to the meeting to which I was invited, along with a lot of other members of the public or who were involved with the environmental movement at the time. And there are also adverts placed in local newspapers, you know, advertising for unpaid staff. I don't think Ian Scott made any money out of this thing. You know, I wish him well with them looking after the wildlife. It's really his other his ideas about society were a bit more dubious, I thought. Like we said, the kind of suggestion of a eugenics agenda was strange. I think he may have picked up some ideas from various places, probably United Nations type sources, and he's probably a bit of an idealist who kind of welded them onto his own desire to look after nature, which is a great thing to do. But I'd suggest that he probably tried to morph them into one kind of way of thinking. And if we come to that fresh, you know, from the conspiracy angle, we see the genuine wildlife parts there that sound good. And then you see he's putting in little bits of information about, you know, extending life to 150 and, you know, the population control aspect that, you know, there may be problems with population sometimes, but the way he's saying it is very much, the tone of it is very much New World Order type of terminology, and the kind of issues, the way he's putting it, you know, particularly when he was talking about extending lifetimes. I mean, that's something the Rockefellers and others have spoken of, extending, you know, an elite's lifetime and then having a smaller general population. And I think they're still continuing, and as I say, I wish them well in their wildlife concerns. I haven't dealt with them since then, but I think they're still putting out similar sorts of stuff from what I've seen, but I haven't seen these adverts recently in the last few years. On the GMO thing, yeah, I mean, it was a big issue back in partly in the 90s. It was sort of just edging into the millennium, but it kind of faded a bit. We had this thing called the five-year freeze that was meant to stop these foods going to the public food supply. I mean, in America, most of the foods now are GMO, or there's GMO stuff in them. In Britain and Europe, we had a freeze. But the five-year freeze must have defrosted by now. I don't know, because I haven't heard of another five-year freeze. And I think if there was a five-year freeze from 1998 or sometime like that, I'm not quite sure what happened afterwards. I think there was a general sense that these foods were not going to be welcome, and consumer pressure kind of kept them out. But, you know, things are creeping in here and there, you know, different chemicals and all sorts of stuff, and I'm not sure it's being monitored now in the same way. You know, there used to be a lot of pressure groups going on about it, but I think they've all moved on to different issues. And it used to be big in the main news, you know, when they were trashing the various fields full of different GMO crops. But the things I was involved with a little bit were standing outside supermarkets and, you know, giving out these stickers, and some of the more hardcore kind of protesters would go inside and stick them on various foods that had GMO stuff in them. And, of course, the supermarkets don't like this when their money's being affected and they look unpopular, and so they did phase it out. But it was very much consumer pressure. And Tony Blair had a sort of semi-consultation. We went and to these various meetings and sat around tables and these kind of groups that you tend to do at these things, very coordinated. You know, have a flip chart or something, and someone has the marker pen and writes down the group's ideas about what you think about GM foods. And in fact, all we wanted was to say we don't want them, but you're given a kind of presentation about both sides of the argument. But if you said that they're bad to start with anyway, if you went in with that view, you wouldn't really want both sides. It was obviously someone trying to put the foods to you and convince you they were a good idea, when in fact you never had them before. You've had thousands of years without these particular things, and suddenly you've got to have them and go to a consultation and write down ideas with a marker pen in a group. So I did go to one of these events, but I didn't particularly take part. And I think actually the public were quite cynical about the process. I don't think they really bought it. I think they could see that it was a bit manipulative. And like a lot of these consultations, it got kind of shoved on the side. I'm not sure what the outcome was. I think they kind of got less support than they wanted. And suddenly it's not a proper consultation when it doesn't get the right answer. Interesting there, mention of Jurassic Park. Of course, that's based on a book by Michael Crichton. The film was made by Steven Spielberg. It's a good film, but it does soften the story a little bit. If you read the original novel, it's got quite a lot of detail in it about genetic engineering and the various, they're called iterations, which is like going to the next stage. Everything kind of goes to the next stage and the next stage. And he has, like, I think, diagrams between chapters of these sort of geometric shapes changing, and it shows how things get more complex, the DNA structure. And in the book, I can't remember in the film, it was a good film, but it did simplify some of the details. But in the book, the dinosaurs are actually crossbred. They're actually frogs with dinosaur DNA put in them. So they're kind of like a strange species, and they're sort of like dinosaurs, but they're not necessarily exactly what real dinosaurs would have been. And like I said, he has a chemical in them where they have to eat that every day. And if they don't get that in their food, then they die. And the real dinosaurs wouldn't have had that. And it's a way of controlling them. I've only seen the sequel once. And I know the dinosaurs rampage more in that. I'm not sure what happens there. They're slightly different. But in the book, they would die in 24 hours. Crichton, who died, unfortunately, recently... which was a great shame, because said he wrote the book. He was also a film director. It's quite rare to be a novelist who can also direct films. I don't think he usually directed his own books. I think he may have done on one or two occasions, but I think usually he tended to direct other things and write the book separately. But he wrote a book quite recently about genetics called Next, and it kind of means what's coming next. It's kind of an entertaining, rather sprawling story. It's not as good as Jurassic Park, but it's still a good read if you find it. It's one of those airport thriller type books, you know, huge fat wadge of pulp with a big typographical cover and one word on it sort of thing. But it's about various genetics companies, and it does cover the patenting of tissue. One of the characters is one of those multi-thread stories, like those kind of TV miniseries where you follow different groups of characters. And one of the groups is someone who has some of his tissue patented, and they're going to make money out of it. But in fact, it's his genes in it, but they kind of copyright him, and he's trying to get the stuff back. And in the story, which is quite convoluted but good fun, various genetic animals are evolved at certain points, and one of them even helps out at the end solving the problem. It's a chimpanzee that's super intelligent. And but it's a good story, because it does show how things can be patented, and this stuff's been in the news, and Michael Crichton was keeping an eye on that and weaving it in to his book. So I hope that might get adapted sometime. I think it'd make a good TV series, because again, like with Jurassic Park, it's good for the big monsters, but they have to simplify a lot of the scientific detail that Michael Crichton did really, really well. And but, you know, some of these airport thrillers are not literary masterpieces, but they can have some good information, often written by authors who are a little bit workmanlike, but they kind of do their stuff in telling a story and getting detail and information, because that's what they like to pass on sometimes. They're not going to give you beautiful poetry in the language, but they'll come up with some good ideas, you know, and a lot of these sort of films are based on that sort of stuff. And certainly here, when we're talking about, you know, the idea of GM foods being a kind of, you know, a way of controlling, they could well be. And, you know, things like fluoride in the water and all these other issues are a little bit along similar lines, I think. Yeah, I was quite defensive of pressure groups at the time. I think I've gone a bit more jaded on them recently. I could see what Scott was saying about them. Yeah, they do empire build to a degree. I'm not sure they do to a huge degree. They're not massively rich, but there's been some controversy very recently in the Haiti earthquake where it was seen that a lot of pressure groups are more concerned about getting their logos in front of the cameras and the money doesn't get to where it's meant to go. And I certainly think a lot of these pressure groups did campaigns and were quite happy to compromise the campaigns and they not see things through when the politicians were kind of diddling them a bit. They often tended to just want to keep their supporters happy, I think. They have money, whether it's a lot of money compared to multinationals and stuff, it probably isn't, but they're all probably started by someone at the start who had an agenda, Club of Rome, things like that. I've often thought you can subvert these things to make them more what you want them to be, but in the end, they're always going to be someone else's organisation started by someone with some other kind of agenda that may be not your own. And of course, if you start from scratch, you'll be tiny and maybe ineffective, but you will be able to do what you want. So hope that's interesting, and keep an eye on the news for anything about GM foods and organisms if it comes up again.
The information where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.